Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin, and you are listening on Thursday, October the 2nd, and I am recording this exactly one day earlier, on Wednesday. This means that it would not be advisable to call in and ask a question because there will be nobody to answer it. And also, by the way, as I explained last week, I will be away for most of the month of October. In fact, I believe I will be returning to PRN on the 23rd of October. Thursday, the 23rd of October, will be my first broadcast back, although I have said that I will attempt to phone in a couple of shows during the meantime, if I possibly can. I've been informed that in my absence, old shows will be replayed. I don't know which ones, but Ryan will select for you a motley of shows for your enjoyment and pleasure, and so you will be kept entertained, ladies and gentlemen. Today, I propose to talk in more general terms about the economy and what it means to you, and in particular, more about what the potential is for a vote and the kind of plan for what they now want to call rescue. They didn't like the word bailout. I think they were very frustrated that somebody had chosen that word, which doesn't express good feelings. It expresses the truth. And, of course, nobody wants to tell the truth in politics. So instead of saying bailout, they now want you to use the word rescue. Okay? It sounds better. It sounds more noble. And it's more likely to scoop up some of those naysayers in Congress who did not vote for the bailout earlier this week. The bailout itself, of course, is an outrage. The bailout simply involves the government scooping up, that's to say, buying at inflated prices, and that's by their own admission, that they will overpay for the dross that is on the balance sheets of various financial companies. The dross being the non-performing or low-performing assets of the mortgages, mostly the subprime and now increasingly the alt-A and prime mortgages, which are coming into play as non-performers, as the price of real estate collapses and people with more wealth and security decide simply to walk away from their mortgages. Based on a business decision. So really what we have here is Henry Paulson, the head of the Treasury, who has decided that his last grand act as Secretary of the Treasury shall be to reward all his friends on Wall Street who created this mess, who turned a blind eye to the anomalies of absurd mortgage giving, meaning that they raked in all the fees both from the mortgages and from the derivative contracts that they masterminded, They are now deep in water, underwater particularly. They are going under like nine pins, although some of them are being rescued by other firms while in a bankrupt situation. They either forgot or abandoned Lehman Brothers, who were allowed to go under. And the purpose of this bailout, rescue, is to pay off these companies, enabling them actually to continue to make the same kind of ridiculous loans that they made in the past, or to otherwise lend money to people to do other ridiculous things. Money, of course, being the least appropriate kind of reward for both the financial services firms and the people who've misspent the money they did have. An absurdity to imagine that giving more money, throwing more of the same problem to the people who created it in the first place, is going to solve anything. Of course, it isn't. But by the time the non-solution has arrived, the current bozos will be in retirement or safely on their yachts miles away enjoying the sunshine. Henry Paulson, of course, will not be Treasury Secretary in the new administration. I doubt that Bernanke will last much longer in his current post as head of the Federal Reserve. These are basically just goons who have made mistakes and are about to be rewarded for it. It is so unconscionable and so unthinkable that the mind truly boggles. But, of course, the first bill failed in Congress, and now they're furiously trying to tweak it so as to get another similar bill through. But they just need one vote of the positive nature to overwhelm the negative side, and of course they've got their precious bill. The modifications are cosmetic and mean nothing in the grand scheme of things, which is that things are going to get much worse, that the $700 billion or $250 billion or whatever it is they're going to draw down at the beginning is nothing more than a stopgap, and it will be carefully written into the bill as such, meaning that they will be able to access more money at will indefinitely. It's very frightening, and all of you should be very concerned that your democracy has come to this, because this is not what was envisaged by founding fathers of this country, and certainly not anything other than the result of the absurd New Deal that was voted in the 1930s, when, despite the Depression, this country was a rich country and had a stellar future. In other words, it would have been very hard to mess things up at that point, because there was so much hidden wealth and so much need for the then fairly priced manufacturing services of the United States worldwide. After the war, they got an additional boost in this country by virtue of the fact that all the other manufacturing countries of repute had been bombed into smithereens, and their facilities were no longer functional. So America, quite simply, had a green light and a head start which lasted 10 to 15 years, and rightfully, America made the most of it. And when you look around and you see all these multinational corporations that America built up at that time, it was really mostly thanks to the inability of the rest of the world to service their own people and their own exports while they were busy rebuilding their own infrastructure. So that's the basis behind where we come. I gave you a whole timeline on this on Monday, starting with, of course, the Federal Reserve, that august institution which is responsible for spinning money out of thin air, which could not have happened before the introduction of the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, which, of course, is neither a reserve nor is it federal, but be that as it may, it has managed to make a mess of things ever since, and the unfortunate American taxpayer has been the recipient of this monster ever since. Right now, there is some confusion among Americans as to the real state of the U.S. economy, because nobody will tell the truth. People seem to imagine that the economy is really just a financial crisis, when, of course, there are very real problems independent from that crisis that are dragging the country into a very serious recession, which, of course, in my terms, is a depression. So the financial problems that they're trying to solve right now will absolutely not be resolved in terms of the recession of the country. The actual recession itself was brought on by the bursting of the housing bubble, which had created $8 trillion of illusory wealth before it began to burst in late 2005. Well, that bubble right now, I would say, is about 60% deflated. And that assumes that there's no overshooting when the market finally does bottom out. And, of course, there always is overshooting, so you can look at a much higher percentage of trouble to come than that 60%. It's pretty easy to identify mathematically where we come from the years 1996 to 2006. U.S. home prices rose by about 70% above the rate of inflation. And prior to this time, home prices over the long term didn't rise faster than inflation. And that's where you get the concept that prices would have to fall about 40% to reach trend levels, and in real terms, they've only fallen about 25%. Now, we've discussed this before, but it bears repeating that there is a large oversupply of homes in the United States. Homeowners are receiving foreclosure notices currently at the rate of about 3.6 million a year. This, of course, is causing the contraction of the construction and housing-related sectors. But, of course, more importantly is the wealth effect seen from the perspective of households that typically borrow against the equity in their homes, really the so-called expansion of the U.S. economy, which was a cruel trick, an illusion, if you like, this was simply a result of this borrowing, the credit that we've all come to know and love. Just to give you an example, at the end of 2006, or rather at the peak of the bubble in 2006, consumers were cashing out $780 billion a year from the then rising home equity. Of course, this has virtually come to an end, probably we're going to see a severe drop in consumer spending, which amazingly has held up despite the collapse of the housing bubble. There's been a slide of the dollar, which has contributed also to the economic growth through exports. Unemployment at 6.1% is pretty much at its September 2003 peak from the last recession, and employment as a percentage of population is near its trough from the last recession. Real wages are falling. The economy has shed jobs at a rate of 81,000 a month. And all this, of course, will feed into the housing market and also weaken consumer spending. And, of course, I've mentioned in the past the state and local government sector, which is going to contract brutally in the future, although it has been adding jobs. The spending is going to have to be cut in response to falling revenues. This is kind of obvious and logical, but it's not being discussed anywhere right now. To give you another example, New York City recently announced $1.5 billion in spending cuts over the next 15 months. The conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, from all this is really that the U.S. downturn has just begun. Whatever problems you may see in the housing market and however far you may care to go back in assessing those problems, the reality is that the figures pertaining to the economy have really only just turned. This downturn will accelerate, and that will happen even if the financial problems, the sector of financial crisis, was to be resolved as efficiently as possible, which it won't. More likely, the problems of the financial sector will continue to contribute to the downturn as the sector itself rids itself of insolvent institutions. And, of course, the restriction of credit that we've unfortunately been living with now for several weeks will magnify any number of times. And I tell you all this because when you discover, ladies and gentlemen, that whatever kind of bill is voted, and I will not be around to discuss this, so using your newfound elements of analysis, you will be able, hopefully, to make accurate conclusions as to what it all means. But using the information that I've just given you, do not be surprised when you hear that despite the so-called success of whatever deal of bailout, rescue comes down to meet us, the economy itself does not improve. The economy cannot improve. Whatever steps are taken to bail out the fat cats on Wall Street, the economy is in many respects totally divorced from this matter and will not improve. And that's the big lie that Paulson and others are trying to ram down your throats. Vote for our bill and your economy will get better. It's not going to happen, ladies and gentlemen. And you'd better understand this very clearly from the get-go, because if you are of a mind to do so, you will constantly be calling your representatives. The numbers are on my site at the archives that you can get hold of them. Call them, fax them, email them, tell them how displeased you are and how you will refuse to vote for anyone who votes for this unconscionable bill, using taxpayer money to reward the people that brought you this trouble in the first place. It's clear, it's very clear that Paulson and Bernanke desperately want to save these over-leveraged banks and hedge funds, whatever the immense cost to the taxpayer and future generations of Americans. Really, you can be as open and as magnanimous in your thoughts as you want about this, but there really is no other explanation for what is going on. A right-minded economist, if he was to be handed $700 billion, he would not hand it to Wall Street. It makes no sense. There is no logic to apply to that ridiculous expenditure of money other than to save the people who are losing money at this time. Nobody has really questioned what the effect would be if, in fact, these firms were to go out of business. I mean, how serious would it be? Already there is a credit crunch and the banks won't lend to each other because they don't trust each other. The LIBOR rate went up to a record late last week as banks had to pay up to receive funds from other financial institutions. You know, the money supply has started to expand. It's at a very high rate now of 16%. You know, Bernanke's goal is to rid banks of mismatched securities and acquire billions of worthless speculative paper for the state. The write-down amount by banks has so far exceeded $500 billion. And it just looks like Paulson and Bernanke have decided that they don't want them to incur any more losses. But this has nothing to do with the American taxpayer. If you're sitting at home scratching your head and wondering what this $700 billion has to do with you and what this threat is that they keep talking about, there is none. There is no threat that could possibly be worse than the concept that these housing markets are collapsing in value and that the homeowners, so-called, are foreclosing in record numbers on their mortgages. None of this money will provide 1 cent of help to the people of the country that are hurting now because of their mortgages and because they are being foreclosed on. None of this money will help them. Understand that very clearly, ladies and gentlemen. Don't ask yourself questions about this. This is not a stimulus package. This is not the same as when they graciously handed you back your money after you had paid it in taxes. This is not the same thing at all. This is a very different form of approach. One of the effects of this will be that the U.S. fiscal deficit will be inflated to an unsustainable level. You know, with the national debt spiking to 86% of GDP, the deficit may seriously undermine U.S. solvency. You know, the Congressional Budget Office has already announced that the cost of the plan is very difficult to assess and could turn out to be trillions of dollars. Just a few more figures here, just bear with me. To a previously projected 2009 record deficit of $500 billion, the bailout's $700 billion price tag, combined with $200 billion already spent on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and $85 billion for AIG, the fiscal deficit would explode to about $1.5 trillion. You know? And what's going to happen when the $700 billion is spent? What will Congress say to another request of, say, $300 billion to save the day? You know? Now, another thing that I think it's important for you to be sure to get clear in all this is that as the Treasury is busy purchasing worthless paper from Wall Street, it will reveal the existence of more worthless paper on the books of financial institutions and cause even more panic. See, this process has no end. And I've explained this before. Nobody knows the extent of the losses in these financial institutions. They took these ridiculous derivative products and spun them off at great leverage onto the off-balance sheet function of their corporate models. And so nobody, including shareholders, has the right to know just how much dross that is on the banks, on the books of these banks. And you don't know, and I don't know, and Bernanke and Paulson certainly don't know. And this is really serious because we're not looking at a finite number here. We're looking at a black hole. And if the members of Congress, maybe if they could just listen to, you know, the Richard Martin wake-up call, if they could only understand that going down this road may be throwing good money after bad money, I assure you they wouldn't even contemplate voting this bill or anything remotely like it. You know, economic growth in this country will be curtailed by a considerable fall in savings and a significant decrease in real government and private expenditures. Real government spending will diminish because most of the expenditures will consist of buying worthless financial papers at the expense of spending on social and economic programs. And I mean, when people say, oh, well, if it wasn't for the war in Iraq, we could spend the money doing this or do that, education, health, etc. If it wasn't for these bailouts we're giving to Wall Street, we could spend the same money on this and that. Yes, but they don't. The truth is, if there aren't problems, they don't deal with the problems there are in a world where there is no payoff. See, they don't look to the people who are uninsured for votes. They look to Wall Street for massive contributions, you know. They look to the major corporations like Lockheed for money, basis the war in Iraq, which is in fact a financial gambit to reward the defense companies, which provide so much of the money that these parties need to get reelected, you know. The amount of defaults will rise, and this in turn will push the purchases of impaired assets to forbidden limits and will aggravate fiscal imbalances. The moral hazard will, of course, increase, and financial disorder will be compounded. You know, it's absurd to have the government, you know, ultimately the taxpayer, pay for the speculative losses of banks and hedge funds. Had these banks invested wisely in productive activities, they wouldn't have faced their current problems in the first place. Don't forget that the current financial disorder stems from the Fed's over-expansionary policy and the monetization of large fiscal deficits, inadequate regulation, and supervision of financial institutions. Thank you very much, Alan Greenspan. We've talked about that, you know, ad infinitum. Speculative credit that we've all got so used to has expanded at dangerous rates at the expense of credit worthiness. You see, in the end, ladies and gentlemen, there is no way out of the mess that the Fed has created. There is no solution. And I mean, you know, you're going to be listening to any numbers of pundits talking on television, on the radio, writing long, boring articles in newspapers and magazines. We should do this, we should do that, this is how it is, this is how it should be, this is what people did wrong, this is how to fix it. There is no fix anymore. They can throw whatever money they want at the problem. They will create a new problem, i.e. greater debt to finance, and they will exacerbate the old problem, namely financial institutions which should be out of business, which are simply going to stagger on, making new bad decisions, paying money to people that shouldn't receive the money, and basically in the end going bankrupt anyway, despite the money which has now been spent and which was spun out of thin air in the first place. It is a nightmare. It is a fiscal and monetary nightmare, ladies and gentlemen. If you could really get it, you would be beside yourselves with fury. It is a disgrace. It is unconscionable. You have to do what you can as citizens to prevent this taking place. You can make your point. You can make a noise. It is already responsible for the fact that a few more people, some 15 or 18 more deputies, actually voted no for this bailout than voted yes. And they did it because they knew that they were not going to be reelected. That's why they voted no. The general feeling is they voted no, hoping the bill would pass anyway, and that other people would vote yes, so they would be let off the hook. Unfortunately for them, there were too many other people like them voting no as well, hoping other people would vote yes. And it didn't work. Next time it may work. So you need to redouble your efforts right now. After this show is over, get on the phones, get on the faxes, and write emails and tell these people you will not vote for them, and you will get other people to not vote for them if they vote for this bill, because I assure you this bill is about to be reproduced and revived in another form, because they won't listen to the voice of the people. This is democracy in action for you, courtesy United States 2008. Thank you very much. You know, Bernanke has brought economic growth to a halt by lowering interest rates and injecting massive liquidity. The dollar is undermined, even though it is soaring at the moment. The food markets have been destabilized. Oil markets have been destabilized. The airline industry has been disrupted. The U.S. and world economy is now in a long-term slowdown and is likely to be brought to its knees before the end of next year. The highly expansionary monetary policy is only setting the ground for an even more severe credit crisis, nationally and internationally. There is only one option, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to see an end to this nightmare in the near future. It is to do nothing, to allow this rot to take its course, to allow the economy to go in the direction in which it wants to go. And that's the only solution here. Because you have to, if people do not perform correctly in business, they have to go bankrupt. You cannot sustain a bad situation. They did it in Japan in the 90s, and look where it got then. And they're doing it again now in the United States. And they'll do it in Europe. They'll do it everywhere, because that's the nature of politics. And there aren't enough enlightened people, like hopefully your good selves, who understand what's going on and can do anything about it. Now, very quickly, I'm going to give you 10 pointers. Some of you will be familiar with this. It's going to be very quick. 10 pointers why you have to vote against this bill. And these pointers, you're welcome to include them in your letters to senators. You know, you need to talk to senators. Now, the right now, as I speak to you, it may be different tomorrow or next week, but right now, the focus is on the Senate, because the Senate are going to vote for this. And the Senate will pass the bill for themselves, and that will put immense pressure on the House of Representatives to do the same thing. You have to stop them doing it. They have to understand that you will not go along with this. So here are 10 reasons that you will have, 10, as it were, links in your armory of arguments that you will have to stop these people voting for this unconscionable bill. Reason number one, the $700 Wall Street bailout, $700 billion Wall Street bailout, is just a drop in the bucket. It will not correct even Wall Street's problems. The idea that $700 billion of Wall Street bailout and bad investments will somehow solidify the markets is simply wrong. It is a lie, and it is designed to force you into making a bad decision. Don't let that happen. The true facts show that there are more than $12 trillion worth of mortgages outstanding in the U.S. alone. Reason number two, the bailout plan smacks of cronyism. Paulson and his advisors are Wall Street alumni. Paulson's close relationship with Wall Street community strongly suggests ulterior motives may impact his recommendations. Reason number three, Paulson and the Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke do not understand the problems confronting the American economy. They are not qualified to be king. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center of Economic and Policy Research in Washington, said, and I quote, "This administration is asking for a $700 billion blank check to be put in the hands of Henry Paulson, a guy who totally missed this and has been wrong about almost everything." End of quote. Reason number four. The bailout plan proposes to give Paulson unfettered discretion to do as he sees fit with no accountability to anyone and no review of his actions either by the courts or administrative agencies. To create a get-out-of-jail-free card for anyone associated with the proposed bailout offers unlimited possibilities of abuse. Take care. Watch out. The red flag is flying, ladies and gentlemen. Reason number five. The Wall Street bailout plan is a knee-jerk reaction, and there may well be better alternatives for spending $700 billion of taxpayer money. This plan, the $700 billion plan, is aimed at a very small segment of American employees. Generally, the group of people who have earned excessive income over many years and who live in ivory towers. Alan Meltzer, an economic advisor to President Reagan, summarized the situation by saying, quote, "This is scare tactics to try to do something that is in the private but not the public interest," end of quote. Reason number six, Bush and Paulson have proposed a bailout plan even though they had no idea of what to do. I mentioned this on Monday. I went into detail about how these people are clueless. They don't have any idea. I talked a lot about how people in positions of power like CEOs depend on their henchmen to bring the business in and to be the powerhouse behind new ideas. They don't do them themselves. They are now pretending that they and they alone understand what's going on in the economy and how best to fix it. They're frauds, ladies and gentlemen. They're charlatans. You know, prior to committing $700 billion of taxpayer funds, the government should at least have a plan on what it's going to do with the money. Reason number seven, the bailout plan will undoubtedly result in a weaker dollar in the long run, though not in the short run, and have many adverse consequences for the American economy. Reason number eight, as I've mentioned, the bailout plan is unlikely to avoid a continuation and a worsening of the recession or depression already in place. Even experts who suggest that there are long-term benefits to a bailout plan note that it could take the better part of a decade before beginning to show any impact on the U.S. economy. Reason number nine, a total lack of transparency exists in this bailout plan. And by the way, it is lack of transparency, which is a very big reason as to why the economy is in the position it finds itself in today. Reason number 10, under the bailout plan, Paulson and Bernanke intend the U.S. to pay above market prices, yes, that's right, above market prices for the assets that the country buys. Bernanke is urging that any bailout plan buy illiquid assets at values above those for which they could be sold on the open market. That sounds incredible, ladies and gentlemen, but it is true. They want the American people to overpay for Wall Street's illiquid assets. And this craven Congress is about to go along with it. Please do your best. This is one of the few moments in history where your votes, your pressure, your actions could impact the situation, if only because there are elections coming up in a month's time. That is your power, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you've got going for you. You have, because of the immensely good timing on this, huge power to change something that otherwise in normal times would make no difference at all. Your Congress people would just laugh at you. This is the one time where you can make a difference. So my answer, or rather my request of you, is that you do this, go back to the website where I give you all of the phone numbers and the email addresses, target those senators that I listed in the site, and call them again and again. If you have the possibility, call them twice a day. Put aside a few minutes of your time to do this. Call your friends. Say each of you should call 10 friends or relations and secure a guarantee from them that they will do the same thing. If you don't know why, if you don't have the full facts, listen to this again. Listen to those 10 points that I just gave you and make sure that your friends are aware of those points. Maybe you could listen to the whole of this particular talk once again And, of course, this is now 24 hours in advance. Who knows what can happen in 24 hours? But you can affect this process, okay? Here's just a comment on Wachovia's chief executive, Robert Steele. Interestingly enough, and I sent out an email to my people on this earlier today, the CEO, Steele, had an interview with Jim Cramer on CNBC's Mad Money, in which he said recently, and I quote, "We're focused on very exciting prospects when we get things right going forward. I didn't have time today to talk about the good things going on at Wachovia." End of quote. Now, that interview wasn't last month or last year. It took place 2 weeks ago, a time when Wachovia's shares closed at $10.71 that same day. 3 days ago, Citigroup bought the company for $1 a share. You know, we've seen this nonsense over and over again, especially during this latest saga about the financial industry. You know, a world predicated on betting billions of dollars of paper on little else than the confidence of the guy on the other side of the bet will be in business tomorrow. You know, a rumor that a company is in trouble can turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy, and this is static. What was going on here? I mean, this deal. I mean, what was he thinking? Did he think he could just spin his way to survival? You know, I mean, after the fact, we point fingers. Were they lying? You know, in hindsight, it always seems that no matter how they rationalize away their comments, they get away with it. And interestingly enough, right now on the Yahoo chat boards, there's a sort of chorus of Wachovia investors, many of whom, of course, bought stock immediately after Mr. Steele's appearance. Of course, they're raging mad, you know, saying things like he should be put in jail, you know. I saw him on CNBC last week, and I thought he said everything was okay. You know, are we sincerely supposed to believe that this guy Steele, who is actually a very bright man, you know, didn't understand, didn't know? It's the same thing with all these CEOs. They all say the same thing. You've got that smiling idiot Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, who's always grinning, telling everybody how wonderful everything is. And, you know, Cisco happens to have a problem. It'll all be over by this time, you know, tomorrow. It works. That's why they do it, because people are so uninformed. But unfortunately, these things work. People buy their stock. Stock price moves up. They exercise their stock options, and then wham, bam, thank you, man, down goes the stock again. You know? There was Cramer 3 days ago on Monday night, the entire segment spent apologizing to his viewers about having Steele on the program and for his own bullish call on Wachovia stock. "I screwed up," he said, referring at one point to Mr. Steele as a friend for 25 years. "I believed in the guy. Did he take advantage of me? Perhaps, yes." Of course, they all justify themselves and try to yield out of these situations. And that's a guy, Steele, to whom the government wants to hand out a little packet of money from the $700 billion. Oh, poor Mr. Steele. Didn't get it quite right this time. Let's give him some money and, you know, try to heal the wound. You know, Steele had to know, going on television that day, that Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, Bank of America brought Merrill Lynch, and AIG was on the brink of collapse. But that was just asking for trouble. Please, are we expected to believe that he didn't appreciate the precarious state of his own company, given the carnage around him? He knew how fast a bank's fate can turn. You know, he and all the other happy talk executives put themselves in legal jeopardy. They're not going to get away with this. You know, I mean, they'll get away with some of it, but they certainly won't get away with a lot. All right, well, I saw an interesting article on the Spiegel Online, which also I posted to the email people. entitled America, Where It Pays to Fail. It talks about how the Bush administration is trying to douse the flames with yet more fuel instead of water, wanting to see Wall Street's gamblers rewarded for failure. And quoting bits from the article, more than 100 years ago, German sociologist Georg Simmel criticized the banks for being even bigger and more powerful than the churches. His chief complaint that money is the new god of our times is still heard today. If Simmel was right, and there are some indications that he was, his statement would have to be modified to suit today's circumstances. Not all people pray to the same god. You know, among money worshippers, there are at least three faiths. First, there are the Puritans, who patiently carry their money to the new churches, hoping that it will multiply. The average Chinese, for example, deposits 40% of his income in banks. Some discipline, huh? Then there are the pragmatists. They save and lend, but only in that order. Huh? Their savings limit their boldness. This persuasion is especially prevalent in the Germanic countries, where the savings bank is the shrine. And then finally, we have the religious community of the uninhibited, which is especially popular in the United States. Its adherents readily admit to intentional recklessness, wanton waste, and omnipresent greed. They call it the American way of life. Its members live in the here and now without asking questions about tomorrow. One lends money to another, even though it's not his money. Instead, he has borrowed it from a third person who has promised to procure it from a fourth person, and so on. Well, this religious community is the most devout of them all. Some time ago, it adopted the practice of treating anticipated money like real money and equating desire with reality. Whatever shred of inhibition they had was now shed. Well, of course, that led to a funding gap or deficit, capitalism without capital, the audacious heart of the innovation, and it couldn't function. There is no worldly salvation. At least that was the conclusion of the old God, the one bearing the cross, and the new God, the one with the dollar signs in his eyes, could agree on. So then you had the Big Bang. Three of the five U.S. investment banks lost their independence, while the other two are still floundering. Two mortgage banks and one insurance company are now under government administration. The global financial system has been shaken. You know, never mind the other two faiths. If one is shaky, the other two fall and everyone dies. Billions of dollars were lent to people who were not creditworthy for condominiums and houses that were not valuable. In the cheerful, cynical jargon of bankers, these types of loans were dubbed NINA, short for no income, no asset. And yet, despite that, things were going well in the world of moneylenders. The miraculous increase in the money supply helped housing prices rise by more than 70% between 2000 and 2006. The industry had managed to turn a profit by increasing risk. On the balance sheets, at least, minus turned to plus. Well, I think it's interesting to note how Karl Marx viewed these things. You know, in better times, one had called the bankers enterprising. Today, they're being called irresponsible. Karl Marx, his take on it was, and I quote, "Capital is as terrified of the absence of profit or a very small profit as nature is of a vacuum. With suitable profits, capital is awakened. With 10%, it can be used anywhere. With 20%, it becomes lively. With 50%, positively daring. With 100%, it will crush all human laws under its feet. And with 300%, there is no crime it is willing to dare, not willing to dare, even at the risk of the gallows." I think I see a lot of today in that. You know, Paulson doesn't intend to use tax revenues to finance the bailout. Instead, he plans to take up billions in new loans on behalf of the U.S. Treasury. He said, and I quote, "I hate the fact that we have to do it, but it's better than the alternative." End of quote. And of course the president approved. You know, that's what happens to religious communities when they become under pressure. They become even more devout. The same short way of thinking that triggered the disaster in the first place is now supposed to bring it to an end. The government is attempting to put out the fire with fuel, not water. In fact, it was precisely the same fuel that sparked the flames on Wall Street in the first place. Borrowed money. The actions of politicians are amplifying rather than mitigating the effects of economic failure. American-style capitalism isn't dead yet, but it's preparing its own demise. The history of these days is the history of a death that has already been announced. Which brings us to Miss Marple. And this is rather fun. The amateur detective dreamed up by Agatha Christie, based on her grandmother, is equipped with more than just a sense of humor and an understanding of human nature. She has also experienced with the obvious, things that no one believes possible until they happen. In the 1950 novel, A Murder is Announced, Christie looked into our future in comic fashion. The story goes like this. One morning, citizens read the following message in the classified section of their local newspaper. A murder is announced and will take place on Friday, October 29th at Little Paddock's at 6:30 p.m. Friends, please accept this, the only intimation. At the appointed time, half the village gathers at the house where the murder will supposedly take place. The warning is treated as a frivolous joke, one that no one would want to pass up. Sherry is served. The group contracts a collective case of the jitters. Promptly at 6:30 p.m., the lights go out. "Isn't this wonderful?" breathed the female voice. "I am so thrilled." When the lights come back on, to everyone's surprise, a murder had been committed. And now we, like the guests at Little Paddock's, are standing around, whispering, getting a case of the jitters, waiting to see what happens next. And no one seriously believes that an actual crime is about to take place. Everybody was silent and nobody moved. They all stared at the clock. As the last note died away, all the lights went out. Delighted gasps and feminine squeaks of appreciation were heard in the darkness. "It's beginning!" cried Mrs. Harmon in an ecstasy. Anyone who hopes to get an early warning should simply expand his or her range of vision for as long as the lights are on. America's credit card companies are not in significantly better position than the banks. They, too, have sold the future and even a piece of the period after that. The American auto industry is also seriously stricken and is having trouble extending its credit lines on the open market. The industry lost more than 300,000 jobs since 1999. But what good does that do if the managers, and not the workers, are to blame for the crisis? America's enormous oil bill, about $500 billion, is currently being paid for with money borrowed from China. Every business day, America's foreign debt grows by close to $1 billion. Probably the bitterest pill to swallow in America today is that private households are not managing their finances any better than corporate executives. They see their mirror images in Wall Street bankers rather than some distorted picture of themselves. I know of no country, indeed, where the love of money has taken stronger hold on the affections of men, Alexis de Tocqueville noted 170 years ago. The long overdue conversation between the government and the governed has yet to materialize. It would have to be a conversation about the relationship between the economy and values, about regaining what has been lost instead of expanding. The word frugality, which disappeared from the vocabulary of the uninhibited, should be reintroduced. But there is no sign of any of this happening. Today's America is too American to survive in its current form. But today's America is also too proud to realize it. The faithful will hardly allow themselves to be converted. And so our understanding of the events continues to get less and less clear. A dangerous game with time has begun. And I translate, I translated from the German by Christopher Felton, I quote, "The ping of two bullets shattered the complacency of the room. Suddenly, the game was no longer a game. Somebody screamed, 'Lights! Can't you find the switch? Who's got a lighter?' 'Oh, Archie, I want to get out of here.'" Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, these banks don't have the capital to make loans. The larger entities are already in the lending business and they're going to suffer themselves. What do you think GE does? And as far as that goes, Exxon, if you dig deep enough. The Arabs are already trying to line up credit and they're supposed to have all the money in the world. The problem is too much debt. And it is a problem as big in China as it is in the United States. It is indeed too much debt which caused the deflation that we're looking at now. People forget because few understand that the dollar collateralizes the credit system around the world. In effect, gives the U.S. a free loan. What we owe is all the money in the world plus some, which is also what they owe. It is such a mess because credit is an illusion. The banks don't have enough money to give everyone their money because they can really only access the Fed to the amount of their capital reserves, which are a fraction of their liabilities, and their capital is melting rapidly. The U.S. owes the world dollars, yet the world needs dollars or whatever is designated in dollars to collateralize their own banking systems. This is why you see stated inflation higher in China than in the U.S., because the relative increase of money on the street in China is increasing faster than the U.S. Credit is going to decline. Who is going out to borrow money and sign on the dotted line in order that someone that can't pay it can buy their goods? Isn't that what happened to Lucent? See, that's the problem. There is no liquidity. There is no money available. The money is not there, ladies and gentlemen. And that is why the dollar is soaring, because people need the dollars. Now, mark very clearly what I just said to you, the last few minutes, what I just told you about credit and the illusion of credit, the world, the fact that America owes the world dollars. Then you will understand why the dollar will rise despite the fact that the U.S. economy is in the dross house. Okay? So, there you have it. When this systemic crisis is overblown, there will almost certainly have been a domino-like collapse of more than a few large intermediaries and sophisticated global firms, hedge funds, insurers, and brokers. And then the counterparty risk we've talked about will take center stage. The lenders, investors, and risk managers will fret and gossip about which institution is next. And worries about fraud and chicanery will boost anxiety to a fever pitch. You know, even firms not in dire straits will find themselves at risk. Remember that. It's not just the bad eggs which are going to be thrown out. The baby really is about to be thrown out with the bathwater here. You know, the concern of the ability of others to manage exposure will spur a self-fulfilling prophecy where idle chatter alone leads to institutions being squeezed or cut off just when they need access to financing the most. Very few areas of the financial system will be unaffected when the meltdown rages. In the insurance sector, for example, debt downgrades and defaults will occur at a quickening pace. Financial Armageddon dead ahead, ladies and gentlemen. No other way to see this. And do not, under any circumstances, be inveigled into believing that things are going to get better or that this ridiculous package of bailouts can achieve anything whatsoever. It is a scandal which this country will never live down for the rest of its days. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, for those of you who came on late, please be advised that I will be away for the next few weeks, probably returning on the 23rd of October. I wish you all a very successful and trouble-free month of October. You know what to do. I've mentioned this before. Please think carefully before doing anything, and please don't send me any emails for the next few weeks because I will not be in a position to answer them. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, bidding you a fond farewell. Bye-bye for now.